No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Marilia isn't with us today. Unfortunately, she's traveling through Europe, but we're excited to have with us two very important guests. One is the former press secretary to President Zelensky, Ms. Mandel, and the other is Daniel Hamilton, a senior fellow from the Brookings Institution. So let's bring on Professor Hamilton. Thanks so much for being with us, Professor. He is the non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center on the United States and Europe. He's president of the Transatlantic Leadership Network and co-leads the United States, Europe, and World Order postdoctoral program at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, probably the best school of its type in the world. So thanks so much for taking time to be with us today, Professor Hamilton.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with what's, been all over the news for the last couple of days. I want to ask you about Russia and what these recent changes that President Putin is considering making. First is the calling up of reservists. He's calling up 300,000 reservists, which is a larger force than was part of the original invasion. Do you agree with the ambassador to the United States that this is an act of desperation?
Well, it is. He is, facing a defeat on the battlefield, which I think was the last thing he anticipated. When they first invaded, in February of this year, they thought they could sort of stroll into Kyiv, decapitate the government, and optimally sort of incorporate Ukraine into a new sort of Russian confederation, or at least have a captive neighboring state. It hasn't worked out that way. It's a grueling, horrific war. But the Ukrainians have made some, surprising successes here recently, and Putin's back on his heels. So that's the important one step he's taken. The other step is coming this week, where these so-called separatist republics in eastern and southern Ukraine are going to hold so-called referenda, which are already managed by the Kremlin, to whether they, secede from Ukraine and become part of Russia. And the Russians then want to use that as a pretext to say if the Ukrainians invade these territories, they're now part of Russia. So Ukraine now invading Russia. This has been condemned the world over as a sham, but they are proceeding, and this will be happening over, between tomorrow and Sunday. You'll see this process start.
And referenda, as you refer to them, this isn't what we think of as a referendum, right? It's not something like, is it similar to what we would do to put something on a ballot and have people vote on it?
Well, that's what they say, but of course it's all rigged, and they already anticipate 90% or more, support for annexation in regions of Ukraine that when they had the real referenda on whether to secede from Russia, all of these areas that are now under Russian occupation all voted massively to leave the Soviet Union, right, to leave Russia and be part of Ukraine. So this is not, there are no international monitors. There's no, you know, this is all being orchestrated by the Kremlin.
And, you know, something that really gets me, and maybe you have some insight into this, is the information that we seem to get on the news media here is that, you know, we see pictures of Russians talking about how they have to get the Nazis out of Ukraine. How does this play? How is this really playing in Russia? Do you have any sense of, are the Russian people getting tired of this? I mean, there's only been a separation of about 30 years, if I'm correct. And lots of Russians have family in Ukraine, don't they?
They do. That's part of, you know, what Putin's claim is that, as he has said, you know, he says, quote, Russia, Ukraine is not a real country. And part of his claim is that, you know, this is part of an integral Russia of some type that's not in the current borders. He also makes this claim that he has some duty, self-proclaimed duty, to protect Russians, you know, speakers, ethnic, even no matter what their real citizenship is, no matter where they are, even if they're not in Russian territory. He speaks of the Ruski Mir, the Russian world, which is not, does not coincide with Russia's borders, and that he has some right to intervene across those borders to so-called protect these people, even if they don't want his protection. That's a recipe for disaster. If you think about a principle that extended to most places around the world, would be, you know, violence, because most countries are multi-ethnic. So this is a dangerous slope here, but you're right, the countries are very deeply connected. And I think, frankly, what he really fears is not what he has said about NATO and all this. It's that a successful Ukraine, a truly democratic, Slavic, you know, success story on Russia's borders would resonate massively through Russian society. It would show the Russian people there is another way. And I think that is really what scares him. Ukraine has not done so well in that path either. A lot of corruption and so on in these 30 years. But I think the Russian people, it's hard in Russia to really give your opinion. And so these public opinion polls, you really have to discount. And they've also suppressed, of course, their own internet. So it's very hard to have real information flowing. But Russian people are ingenious. They have devised ways to get around that state internet through other types of social media outlets. And that's a very free and open, you know, debate happening. They're also voting with their feet. A lot of people are leaving Russia. There's a huge brain drain right now. It was interesting, as soon as Putin made the announcement of mobilizing reserves, all the flights out of Russia were fully booked within hours.
Wow.
People trying to get out of the country. So this is it's a volatile thing. The other thing you're seeing, which is interesting, is that the even more nationalist Russians, the pundits, the commentators, the social media, are now criticizing the Kremlin for, you know, losing. And so he's getting now critique from the other side, those who think you should go further and escalate even more. So that constituency, frankly, is a tougher one to combat, given, you know, Putin's hold on power. So he is under some pressure at home. There's no doubt about it. And he's coming under greater pressure abroad. Both the Chinese and the Indian leaders meeting with him recently, you know, in public, said they had real questions about what he was doing. So he's in a corner.
Since you mentioned the Chinese, let me ask you, do you think we sent Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan to send a message to the Chinese to stay out of this? Do you think that was premeditated on our part? I'm asking you to speculate.
It's hard to know. I do think Speaker Pelosi has had a long history of support for Taiwan.
We do here in Washington, too. That's why I asked the question. The Taiwanese feel a kindred spirit with Washingtonians who are controlled by their national government but not given a voice. I don't want to digress, though. Let me move on. How is the rest of Europe? They must be apoplectic. People like the Lithuanians must be just apoplectic about this. Do they think that is the feeling in Europe around the former Soviet bloc countries that this is a first step, and that after Ukraine there's going to be more?
Well, certainly they do. I think the one way to think about it is Putin didn't just invade Ukraine. He really invaded Europe. He invaded everything that Europe stands for. And so even countries in Western Europe, even the Spanish prime minister the other day, Spain on the far western edge of Europe, not in danger of a land attack from Russia anytime soon, said Putin invaded us, not just Ukraine. And so the Baltic states, they have bad memories of Moscow, occupation. And countries on the eastern flank are very nervous because Putin said, we won't necessarily stop with Ukraine. I mean, he said it explicitly. So we're doing a lot with our NATO allies to shore up those countries that are part of NATO. Ukraine's not part of NATO.
But it's
going to be very hard. And I don't think we should think that this will be over anytime soon.
Well, you know, it's kind of classic military knowledge that you don't invade Russia during the winter, and winter is coming. Do you think that's part of? I mean, since it's here, I'm sure the winters in Ukraine are not much better than the winters in Russia. Do you think that's really motivating them to make a hard push now because they know it's going to be even harder in a couple of months for them to move forward?
Well, it seems to, again, not knowing all the inner details, it seems to me what both sides are probably pushing to is some type of pause as the weather gets colder to sort of regroup and to establish as much control and advantage as they can in these months now before that happens. So if Putin mobilizes reserves, they're not coming anytime soon. They'll need to get organized. So he needs some time. He's buying a bit of time now. The Ukrainians have made these advances, but they're also suffering horrendous losses. They need a breather too, and I think both sides are going to probably try to use that time to reposition themselves for a fight that is likely to come again after the turn of the year. So that's why I say, stay tuned, because I don't think this is going away anytime soon. And I actually met the Deputy Defense Minister of Ukraine on the weekend. He was here in Washington. And, he said, we bet we're going to win, but he said, we're going to, you'll see what happens next year. So, I mean, even he had said in public a statement about next year. So I think that's what they're thinking toward, is try to gain as much advantage as you can now, regroup, and then, another phase of the conflict will come.
How much credit should we take for the Ukrainian success? How much do you think? Do you have any sense of that? How much military aid from the United States has really helped these guys? I know that they give us a lot of credit, but have we been? Do you think we've been the deciding factor in the battle, or is it this incredible, resistance put up by the Ukrainians?
Well, it's hard to, say exactly who's decisive. The Ukrainian determination not to lose their country to Russian invaders, I think, is absolutely decisive. They have shown incredible will, ability to absorb, you can't even believe the losses they've taken to their country and their people. You think about the crimes of humanity, these mass graves, all these things we're discovering, and yet they fight on. So absolutely dependent on that steely determination. On the other hand, I think on the margin, on the battlefield, the kinds of weapons that we have been providing has helped them, make these advances. It has stopped the Russians in ways that they hadn't anticipated. I don't think the Russians had counted on such support. And it's interesting that, you know, Putin invaded Ukraine in 2014. This is not the first invasion. Yeah. This has been going on for 8 years. And since that time, we have been helping Ukrainians build their resilience, help their cyber capabilities, done their training, a lot of things that were, you know, not glamorous stuff or not on the television, but were helping the Ukrainians prepare for, frankly, what's now happened. And our NATO allies have done much of the same. So I think some of the training, some of the preparatory tactical training, our intelligence support to the Ukrainians all through this campaign, including now how they could have managed these battlefield successes, that's been quite important, I think. So we are important to them. We are absolutely critical in many ways. But in the end, it's, of course, they're on the front line. They're defending Europe. They're defending, frankly, the Atlantic Alliance, and they're not even a member of NATO. So it's quite something.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm a student of history, so this, in my opinion, has been a real miscalculation by him because the Russians who are, you know, Ukrainians by a different name, you know, they're very closely related. They're famous for their resistance in the Second World War, things like Stalingrad. They were just, they really broke the back of the Nazis. And I think it really was a miscalculation on his part to think that these people were just going to roll over. But let me ask you, what about his threatening to use nukes? Is that saber rattling? When he says all means possible, is that saber rattling, you think, on his part? Or do you think he really has the political will and intestinal fortitude to actually do that?
Well, I think he does. I think the basic point I would make is I don't see Putin reconciling himself with the loss of Ukraine as he thinks about it. He doesn't want to go down in history as the leader that, quote, lost Ukraine.
Yeah.
And so what that means is if he becomes more desperate, one should not be surprised to think he will reach for a variety of other types of tools. He showed that this week. He did these sham referenda, and he called up his reserves. This is a multi-front war. It's not just a land war. There's a whole maritime dimension with the Black Sea, you know, about those grain shipments and how you can weaponize food and people and energy, and all of this is happening. So he has lots of levers besides the military to escalate, to disrupt, and to surprise us. And it doesn't have to necessarily be in Ukraine. So I think the more you see this desperation, we need to anticipate that we will be challenged in some other kinds of ways. Now, whether it goes to nuclear or not, I believe he is capable of that. But there are two dimensions of the nuclear. One is detonation of a nuclear weapon is sort of a shock, which would have obviously devastating effect. It would cross a historic line. It would have lots of ripple effects. But it's not going to obliterate the country of Ukraine unless it would be a massive attack, and frankly, Russia would suffer as much from that as anybody.
Right.
But the more immediate concern most people have is that either intentionally or unintentionally, nuclear power plants in Ukraine could start to leak. And, you know, the Russians have been shooting out of an occupied power plant at Ukrainian civilians and infrastructure, just daring the Ukrainians to fight back. The UN has been there, very nervous that this could, you know, leak. They almost hit another one with a missile, almost another, just directed almost on a power plant. So, you know, Ukraine is a big country, and it's got lots of nuclear power plants. This is the place of Chernobyl, you know, the radiation leak from the 1980s. This is the place where it happened. So that fear is even more present, I think, for most people than the idea that somehow a military nuclear military strike would happen.
And that would give him some political cover, too, wouldn't it, to be able to say, well, we didn't do anything. This is the fault of the Ukrainians that the power plant is leaking. So, but let me ask you, since you brought up the Black Sea, what about Turkey? What about the president of Turkey, Erdogan, saying that he supports Ukraine now? Is that a big development?
Well, the Turks have been supporting Ukraine through military weaponry, including these drones that have had such effect on the battlefield for a long time.
Oh,
so Erdogan has been, he's a very transactional politician. He seeks the best deal as he sees it for his country. And so he's been talking to Putin. He has arranged lots of things with Putin, and then at the other time he supports the Ukrainians. He has been engaged in the Azerbaijani-Armenia conflict, which is also now, erupted again. Mm-hmm. But then steps back from that. And then you can't get ships into the Black Sea unless you go through the Bosphorus,
right,
which Turkey controls. And so Turkey is as a choke point there over everyone in the world wants to get in or out of the Black Sea. So how they use that influence has been important as well. So Turkey's a major player, it's a NATO ally, difficult ally, but really quite strategic. And it'll certainly play a big role. And if you think about the broader set of disturbances, let's put it that way, that are going on in that part of the world.
Speaking of NATO allies, now I'm sorry, I should know more about this, but at the beginning, it seemed that the French were dragging their heels on their, support or their involvement. Are they still in that position, or are they stepping up to the plate?
No, the French have joined in full-heartedly as a NATO ally. They're also supplying everything, that they can together with many of the other allies. They're part of the different coalitions that are discussing how to move things forward. Macron has talked to Putin, to stand down. They're doing what they can. The NATO allies all met in Madrid in June and issued, very tough statements about what this all means. I think there was a unity there you haven't seen for a long time. And they have basically moved to a new posture on the eastern side of NATO, and France supports this, to sort of beef up the presence. That will be more troops. It'll be forward, deployment of troops, including U.S. forces, activating more rapid reaction type of capability. So there's a lot happening on the NATO front in response to this. It's just that NATO is not a direct combatant, with Russia. They're trying, right, to avoid hitting NATO directly against Russia, which could lead to many other types of challenges, of course.
Yeah, of course. The President of the United States, President Biden, speaks before the United Nations. Do you expect the United Nations to take a stronger stand on this? Do you think the United Nations, after this week, after their meetings, will do anything different than they're doing now?
I think the UN at that political level is simply handicapped that Russia is a veto-wielding member of the Security Council.
Right.
So it's very hard at that level to really count on the UN. But UN agencies, the ones that people don't think about as much, do, very important work. If you think about their agency dealing with nuclear safety, atomic energy, those are the experts that went sent into this power plant to look and inspect it and and both sides agreeing to let people like that go in and make sure these things are safe or to assess how unsafe they might be. That's a role the UN can play. The UN can play a role in terms of helping the grain shipments get out across the Black Sea through, back to the rest of the world, to people who are hungry. It can facilitate a whole range of things like that, usually through these other agencies of the UN rather than thinking about the New York headquarters and, the Security Council. That, right, I think, is going to be blocked.
Well, any threat to the United States, I mean, Putin, again, has made comments that for us to stay out of this. Obviously, we're not giving them long-range missiles, which I understand. It's no different than what we did when the Soviets tried to go into Cuba. But is there any threat to the of any kind of, in your opinion, direct retaliation to the United States?
Well, at the moment, they have the Russians have not chosen that step, except in the unseen war we don't see every day, which is in the cyber world.
Right.
I mean, this is a world of persistent confrontations happening every day. We don't see it a lot, but, you know, Russia has tremendous capabilities. You see how they manipulated our elections. They have done lots of things. There's no reason to think they won't continue to do that. We have midterms coming up. You see how they've hijacked certain kinds of social media in the United States, pretending to be, you know, Black Americans or Texans, or, you know, and just feed divisiveness and hatred. They have played a role like that. But more soberly, you can implant malware, you can implant things in our infrastructure that are sort of lurking time bombs. And I have every reason to believe that they have already done that, as we have probably done to them. If you think about the Solar Winds attack that affected so much the U.S. a number of years ago, that was the precursor to that was something called NotPetya attack in Ukraine. The Russians have been using Ukraine for years as sort of a laboratory for cyber operations, attacking their electricity, their infrastructure, their grids. And if it works there, they take it on the road. So yeah. Ukraine, you know, helping Ukraine become resilient to that is not just a good thing to do. It actually helps us with our own national security so we can block that type of activity. So that's where I think the blowback that's happened to the United States is in this kind of sphere that, you know, is very secretive. No one talks about it, but I think it really is, you know, a frontline type of issue.
Well, Professor Hamilton, we very much appreciate you sharing your insights with us. Before we bring on Press Secretary Mandel, let me ask you, is there anything that you want to add, something that we didn't, that I didn't ask that you want to add?
Well, I say, you know, if you listen to all the talk shows and the generals and everybody on these shows, they all like to say, how will this end? And I think that's not the right question. The question is probably, how will this continue? Because it will continue over quite a bit of time. And we have to be prepared for a Europe now that's just, the farther east you go, is turbulent and unsettled and sporadically violent. And that's the world that we're facing, and together with our allies. And we have to be now prepared for that world. We're not going to go back to some other era. This is a new type of age of disruption, basically. And it really challenges us all to think harder about the role of the U.S. in Europe and with Europe as we go forward. So it's emblematic of a big, much bigger set of issues. It's not just about a conflict in Eastern Europe. It's something bigger.
Well, that's a perfect place to leave it with you. And I hope as this progresses, maybe we can get you back on the show in the future to talk about some of those other issues. But we thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule, especially now when this is on the front burner, to be with us today. So thank you.
Absolutely.
And please enjoy the rest of your day. And thanks so much for being with us.
Okay. Pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much.
All right. You too. Now we're going to bring on former Press Secretary Mandel. We're going to discuss what's going on in Ukraine from the Ukrainian perspective. We learned a little bit about what the Russians, you know, how the Russians are dealing with this. Let's talk about how the Ukrainians are doing this with somebody that really knows President Zelensky and the Ukrainian people. So we have Yulia Mandel, who was the former press secretary to President Zelensky of the Ukraine, and she's just written a book called The Fight of Our Lives, Ukrainian Battle for Democracy and What It Means to the World. So can we start right there, Ms. Menzel? What does it mean to the rest of the world, this fight in Ukraine?
Well, Senator, thank you for giving me your platform. This is a very major fight. This is the fight between not Ukraine and Russia. This is actually much beyond these geographical and political positions. This is the fight between democracy and autocracy. And this is the fight where Ukrainians are sacrificing our lives just to stand for the value of our values of the free world, for the rights to choose, for the right to live in democratic country, for the right to join the West in many ways. And democracy must show that they are stronger than autocracy, because if democracy loses, this will mean, you know, so much for the world order, and it will mean that dictatorship wins again. If we feed Russian imperialism, then it can cost a lot to the whole world.
Well, you know, I think we're all amazed at the resilience and the resolve of the Ukrainian people. They've just been amazing. We just had a senior fellow from Brookings who is in charge of studying this part of Europe, and he said that the Ukrainians have just suffered immeasurable losses that we don't even know in the Western world what the Ukrainians have sacrificed at this point. Where do you think they get this resolved? Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, Senator, I wanted to say that just like an hour ago, I read a news from Russian opposition media, like opposition Russian media tried to do some good job there. And they tried to refute the words of Russian Minister of Defense, who said that there were over 80,000 of Ukrainian servicemen who were killed by Russia in this war. But they said that they counted 62,000. And this number is really very impressive, because we are the army that is enlisted from just ordinary men and people who decided to sacrifice, right? And I'm describing in my book, The Fight of Our Lives, that Russia actually returns all their sorrows from 20th century, from Second World War, from the genocidal practices, from the artificial famine. And that's why many Ukrainians still cannot believe it's happening, though we experience it on the ground and we see what's going on. And so many of our friends and relatives, they suffer. And we know so many people who die. We just must stop this war, and we must stop it on the terms of democracy, not on Kremlin's terms.
Do you have the feeling, we've just seen President Erdogan of Turkey stand up and vocally support Ukraine? We know that he's been supporting Ukraine in other ways, but do you see more support garnering for Ukraine and for democracy? Is the support for Ukraine growing, you think, around the world?
Well, thank you for this question. It's really an important one. First of all, let me say thank you to every American, because being here in America, I see how important it is for ordinary citizens, like for the people of America, because they understand what is the value of freedom. And I think that Americans and Ukrainians, we both share the freedom as fundamental value for the society. Now, but secondly, let me say that, yes, we see the support from the governments of the United States, of the European Union, and of Turkey. If you ask me about Turkey and President Erdogan, he has huge influence in that part of the world. And he has established relations with Vladimir Putin for a long time. And it means, of course, a lot that he stood up for Ukraine, because he has also, his people have connections with the Ukrainian people, with the Crimean Tatars, which is the part of Ukraine. and Ukrainian peninsula Crimea was annexed by Russia. So here he participates and he provides the platform. But also, you know, we saw the speech of President Biden, and it means a lot for Ukraine because he was very vocal, he was very sound to say that United Nations need to stand for the major chapters and to show that, you know, he was vocal saying that actually Russia became an aggressor and Russia violated the major chapter of the United Nations. Actually, the United Nations were created to avoid annexation of independent countries, annexation of territories. And here what we see, the aggression, tortures, killing, murders. So this speech was really very important. And we hope that there will be actions after this and that Russia can actually be dismissed, at least from the Security Council, because this doesn't make any sense, and that Russia can be held accountable after Russia is defeated in this war.
Given what you just said, we know that the United Nations is meeting this week and that President Biden is addressing the United Nations. Do you expect the United Nations to do something differently, to take maybe a more aggressive stance against Russia? We know that that's hard to do because the Russians are on the Security Council, but do you think that the United Nations is moving to be more supportive of Ukraine, I guess is what I'm asking?
Well, thank you. Ukrainians understand, you know, what the this type of bureaucracy means, but this is like when we cannot put bureaucracy above reality. And if the United Nations want really to show the result, they actually need to step in and to follow to the rules that were accepted for creation of the United Nations in general. So let me say that, you know, I think that all Ukrainians applauded when President Biden said that we need to follow by the rule, not by the power of one nation, right? And he said that we are actually the heirs of the history, and we need to resolve, you know, unmistakable resolve that nations of the world are united still and that we stand for the values of the UN Charter. So this is, you know, it's very important to understand that if the United Nations cannot follow the major chapters and the major rules that they accepted to avoid the war, and if they cannot stop the war, then what's the point of the United Nations? This is when there is the call, and today at 4 p.m., the Ukrainian president will have the speech in the United Nations, and this is the call for the United Nations to be more active and actually to expel or to limit the country that is behaving as a terrorist and that is actually returning us to the horrors of the past from equal participation in the decisions of the United Nations.
Well, you were very close. I want to change the focus a little bit. You were very close to President Zelensky. You were his press secretary. And I think Americans see him as an enigma. We really don't, you know, he's a surprise, you know. And we think in history that there's been people that have been drawn to exactly the right place in history. For Americans, it's Abraham Lincoln, who saved the Union. For Europeans, maybe it's somebody like Winston Churchill, who saved Britain during the Second World War. Is President Zelensky, is he the perfect man for the job? Has he found himself in just the right position at the right time?
Well, Senator, in the book, The Fight of Our Lives, I'm explaining this transition from Zelensky comedian to Zelensky a statesman and President Zelensky a leader of the country in the war. And I must say that working with him for 25 months shoulder to shoulder, I saw how much he was underestimated because of his major image of a comedian. In fact, he is a lawyer by a degree, and he really built a huge business in Ukraine. It's actually the empire of humor that was popular not only in Ukraine, but on all post-Soviet states. And this took enormous attempts because Russia was trying to ban his business. Russia was stopping his performances, penetrating into information and entertainment spheres in Ukraine. And you cannot, you know, just be funny guy and build this huge empire and lead this huge empire. So I think that he developed as a leader, but also working with him, I must say, he's such a hardworking person. Like, literally, even his biggest critics, they understand he's so dynamic and so hardworking. He can work 24/7 in times of crisis. That's why he drinks enormous cups of coffee. And that's why, you know, before the war, he used to be addicted to sports. Literally, he was starting his day only from the gym or jogging, even if we were going in the trip abroad or going to Donbass. I'm sure that you know, Senator, that Russia invaded Ukraine for the first time back in 2014 right. In the eastern part of Ukraine. And yeah. We were traveling there, and I saw him actually going to the front lines just to handshake with the people, with the soldiers who were there. And I saw when the shelling was starting, and his security, personal security, didn't allow him to go there. But I saw how he fought that, saying, I'm a leader. I need to be with my soldiers there. If I'm a leader, how can I escape the threat? And he was going to the zones of shelling. So that's why I must say he was underestimated. But when he was offered to leave Kyiv, I was really surprised that, you know, he was even offered that for the reason that I knew he would stay with the people. He always repeats that politics must serve people. And that's why people prized him. And he did like this huge contribution of staying in the country, uniting the nation and uniting the whole civilized world to stand with Ukraine in this crucial fight for our very existence.
You know, I mean, absolutely appears to me that he's the perfect, you know, that he's done just an amazing job garnering support for Ukraine, as you just mentioned. And that's been so important to the effort. I really think he's one of those people, and this is my personal opinion, that's found himself in the perfect place at the perfect time. And I can't imagine that anybody else in that position would have done any better than he's done. But let me ask you.
That's a very good saying, by the way, and I agree fully with it, because we were thinking if we had another president, we were thinking that probably anyone would leave. So yeah. You were saying just, you know, perfect explanation, description of the situation.
Well, let me ask you, as, you know, Vladimir Putin, it seems that he has no limits. And this week he's come up with a couple of really draconian new maneuvers, one of which is to call up 300,000 reservists, which is more than the original invasion force, and also these referendum. How do you think, mm-hmm. do you think this will stick, especially the referendum? That really bothers me, because we know it's going to take time to get the troops together, but will this stiffen the resolve of the Ukrainians, you think, these fake referendums that he proposes?
Yes, that's a very difficult situation. Let me explain to the audience that Russians want to hold fake referenda in the occupied territory of Ukraine, which right now is a little bit less than 20% of Ukraine. And in this way, they want to say that now these are Russian territories, and now if we try to regain these territories, they will say that we are attacking Russia, and this will justify any measures that, you know, Putin can take, even maybe some kind of nuclear weapons. Usage, which is really very and very scary. Putin behaves as if he is a monkey with a grenade, and I'm sorry to say this, but this is true. And I know that he is has a very outdated worldview, and he doesn't really understand the world, which went really very far with the progress. He didn't believe any kind of results in Russia. Russia just stuck in Soviet poverty, and it just going back and back with degradation. That's why he tries to show his power in aggressive manner, trying to conquer the biggest democracy, which is Ukraine right now. Ukraine is the biggest territory of freedom and the biggest democracy in post-Soviet region. We are afraid of usage of nuke. This is very scary. And we see that the White House and President Biden really showed the concerns and understand that this can be done. But if they use it, you know, we hope that the NATO countries, they won't stand aside and just won't watch how it's happening. And personally, I'm going back to Ukraine.
God bless you. I
belong to this territory, and, you know, I need to hope that everything will be all right. So right now we are looking forward what's going to happen with this referendum, but not Ukraine, neither the United States, neither the European Union and Turkey are going to recognize this referendum. That's why we consider it Ukrainian territories, and we are going to do all the things to regain them back.
How about the other former parts of the Soviet Union, the countries like Lithuania, Poland? Well, Poland was never a part, and Poland is a NATO country. But how about the other Soviet bloc countries? Do you see them giving military aid to Ukraine? I mean, are they going to? Do you think any of them will send in troops to help Ukraine?
Well, majority of the countries that used to be under a communist regime, like Poland or Baltic states, they are actually a part of NATO countries. And we see that NATO is expanding, having Sweden and Finland, excepting Finland and Sweden. There is one country, which is Moldova, which is not the part of NATO and which is moving with Ukraine together to the European Union right now. They have also problems with Russia because back in the 90s, Russia annexed part of their territory too. And also in the same way, blackmails Moldova with gas, energy resources. All of them, all these countries, they're trying to get away from Russia. And Poland, for instance, increased its army 3 times. Poland is preparing with everything that is possible to help Ukraine, and it provided a lot of resources. At the beginning of the war, there were a lot of military coming from Poland through Ukrainian western cities to Kyiv when Russians approached so fast to Kyiv. So we see a lot of real support, and Poland, for instance, accepted around 2.5 million of Ukrainians, which is like really a large number of refugees. The European Union is helping. If we talk about other countries, we see doubts from some of the countries. Germany is really very, you know, late with providing help, but they do. They changed their mind, and they also suspended the Nord Stream 2, which is very important for Ukraine. It changes the whole world order, because the whole world order is now looking for other resources. They're looking how to ban Russian oil and Russian gas. They are getting many brands are getting out from Russia. I'm explaining even in the book, The Fight of Our Lives, that people even were getting rid of Russian vodka, which means, you know, that people don't want to have any product from Russia. And, you know, Russia needs to feel that they are behaving, I'm sorry to say, but they are behaving like Germany during the Second World War. They just try to expand Putin's ego, imperialistic ambitions. And this can lead really to a tragedy. And this will not be just a tragedy of Ukraine. You know, Putin is not going to stop. So that's why we asked to stand with Ukraine right now to try, you know, to defeat them in our territory, to get them out from our territory. And we believe that it is possible because Russians already see that they are servicemen. They don't have, you know, good equipment. They don't have fuel. They don't have food. They don't have motivation. They are really in a very low morale. and we have eliminated 54,000 of Russian servicemen, which is also a huge number.
Huge number. And what about the, you know, Ukrainians and Russians are very closely attached in many ways. And lots of Russians have family in Ukraine, and I'm sure mm-hmm. it goes the other way as well. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense how the Russian people feel about this? You know, all we get is the propaganda from Russia. Mm-hmm. So we always see right. smiling Russians saying, yes, we got to mm-hmm. get rid of the Nazis in Ukraine. But do you see kind of support in Russia waning for what's going on in Ukraine?
The problem is that Russians inside the country also get only Russian propaganda.
Yeah.
And this is really bad. So you're right that Ukraine had a lot of ties with Russia, for the connections, for the reason that we spent for over 74 years in one country, which was called the Soviet Union. So, mm-hmm. yeah, you're right. A lot of families had connections in Russia, and I hear really bad things from the families. It's not like just one example, dozens and dozens of examples when people and families just collapse for the reason that people there in Russia, they believe in propaganda, and they say to our people, please wait, we will liberate you.
Yes.
Like, we understand that you've got Nazi regime. But we also know that there is a Russian opposition. And what I've heard from the people who left Russia and who are really Russian intelligence, you must feel that they were fighting Russian regime for all their life. And they feel like this is the last battle and they are failing because they allowed this war to happen and they have dictator in Russia. And what I've heard from them really struck me because they said that we understand that Ukrainians have full right to hate us and we just want to hear the West to hear that Ukraine must win. This is the latest what I heard and this really... you know, heartbreaking because I understand that these people devoted all their life to be an opposition for a dictatorship and they feel like this is their personal tragedy and the only way how they can win if Ukraine wins.
Well, we know that you're very busy right now with everything that's going on, so I'm going to let you go in a minute. But you have such an important voice on these issues. I want to ask you one last question, and that is there anything that you want to add, something that I haven't asked, besides telling people how they can get your book? One of my staff people has sent me the book, and I haven't had time to read it yet, but I promise I will, because it's such an important thing. Can you tell us how to get the book, and is there anything you want to add?
Thank you so much. I think the book is sold in different bookstores. I've seen it in New York and Washington, but also it's, of course, on Amazon. In fact, you know, this is my personal story, and this is my story as a new generation of independent Ukraine. Through my story, I show what is the fight for democracy, the fight against oligarchs, the fight against corruption, the fight towards market economy, you know, and this all the personal fight that expands to the whole fight of my people right now. And I'm sure that you will see it with my eyes and you will understand why we all stayed in Ukraine and why millions of Ukrainians feel like this country has a lot of value and it's worth of fighting for it. So the fight of our lives, thank you so much for this platform, for the opportunity to talk to you. And thank you, Senator, for your attention to Ukraine. This means for us a lot.
Well, no, thank you. Thank you for the work that you've done. And please know that so many of us in the United States stand behind Ukraine. And I think you're right. This is not just about Ukraine. I think the world is starting to see that. You mentioned how the Germans are coming around and the French have come around. NATO stands firmly behind you. And God bless every Ukrainian. I wish you all the best. We leave our show every week with a song dedicated to our guests. So this goes out to you, Ms. Mendel, and everybody in Ukraine. Here's an oldie but a good one, goodie from Destiny's Child called I'm a Survivor. Thank you so much for being with us.
Have a good one. Thank you so much.
You too.
Now that you're out of my life, I'm so much better. You thought that I'd be weak without. without you, but I'm stronger. You thought that I'd be broke without you, but I'm richer. You thought that I'd be sad without you, I love harder. Thought I wouldn't grow without you, now I'm wiser. Thought that I'd be helpless without you, but I'm smarter. You thought that I'd be stressed without you, but I'm chilling.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.